Hello there, this is Gary Gerani, film critic, filmmaker, screenwriter, and your host for this final episode of Rod Serling's Night Gallery, which was telecast May 27th, 1973. This was the show's third season, its last season, and it had been cut down from an hour to a half-hour series and moved to a different night, Sunday, although it still had the formidable NBC mystery movie as a lead-in. Now, since I provided the commentary for the very first Night Gallery experience, the acclaimed two-hour pilot, it seemed to make sense that I handle the very last episode as well, taking things full circle. Curiously, the surprisingly high ratings for this final installment actually match the equally high rating of the pilot. Too bad there wasn't a similar match in creative quality. Now, the term half-baked means a creation that has some interesting things going for it, but the execution is off, and the ideas are not fully or even adequately explored. I'd say Hatred Unto Death is, well, maybe a quarter-baked, with the participants jumping headfirst into an obtuse tale of racial memory and ancient blood feuds that would be a challenge for even an experienced filmmaker. In this case, cinematographer Gerald Perry Finnerman was embracing his first opportunity to actually direct after handling the director of photography chores on numerous Night Gallery episodes. The script, by Gallery veteran Halstead Wells, who had just given us the remarkable Sin Eater one season earlier, is something that more closely resembles a first draft than a camera-ready teleplay. The concept is murky at best, the characterization's unreal and uninvolving. Interestingly, the best part of Hatred Unto Death, maybe what we just saw right now, Serling's well-delivered introduction, makes the story's exotic notions actually sound intriguing. We'll find out otherwise 23 minutes later. As mentioned, the two lead players are not well served by this material. Only third billed Fernando Lamas comes off with his dignity intact. Notice that Steve Forrest signs his name Stephen Forrest here, with a PH, no less. Writer Wells based his teleplay on an obscure short story by Milton Geiger, who penned many tales for radio and early TV. So, Africa, folks, courtesy of Universal's Stock Footage Library. Africa, of course, formed the basis of other Night Gallery and Twilight Zone scary tales, the Dark Continent's inherent sense of mystery and primal danger always potent. There's also the social morality theme of what outside nations have done to the continent. In any event, we are introduced at this stage of the game here to the seemingly normal and well-adjusted husband and wife team who are studying animal behavior in the wilds. It's almost like Born Free, but with simians rather than lions being their focus. That's Steve Forrest as Grant Wilson, Dina Merrill as his wife Ruth. In the teleplay, we actually hear Ruth reciting her idea for their new book's introduction, a poem by W.H. Carruth. And I quote, "A fire, mist, and a planet, a crystal and a cell, a jellyfish and a saurian, and caves where cavemen dwell, then a sense of law and beauty, and a face turned from the clod. Some call it evolution, and others call it God." Well, whether Universal didn't want to risk a lawsuit, or Finnerman and company just felt it was all superfluous, we'll never know, but this poem was cut. And what it really gave us, I suppose, was that Ruth has her mystic side, and that will have some bearing on the plot later on. You know, the depiction of African natives in films, past or present, has become a sensitive subject. Let's just say that these characters are here simply to move us into the next plot point, which comes up immediately. Those animalistic growls sound pretty familiar. We heard them from Pickman's models and other monsters featured in earlier Night Gallery episodes. Anyway, the point here is that the locals have captured an especially aggressive gorilla. And it doesn't take very long for our scientific couple to sense something disturbingly weird about this animal. He seems to be taken with the woman, Ruth, and he instinctively hates the man, Grant. Stranger still, Ruth seems drawn to this primate in some curious way, while Grant wants him defeated like a hated adversary, humbled and humiliated. Getting past the inherent oddness of all this, one has to admit that this story is tapping into themes that are explored, or at least touched on, in such highbrow classics as Beauty and the Beast, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, as Rod Serling pointed out, and even Moby Dick. I suppose, you know, metaphorically speaking, Gni the Gorilla, whose name actually means God of Violence in Watusi, is akin to Melville's white whale. It's nature personified as a flesh-and-blood beast, God himself, impossibly bigger than any mere man could be. man has a habit of defying nature, humbling nature, and in the case of Captain Ahab, spitting in the Almighty's eye. There's a bit of that in Hatred of Death. Then again, like Mr. Hyde, the gorilla represents humanity in primal form, the beast unrestrained, before he evolves into his current so-called civilized entity. Man seems to naturally resent the beast that still resides within him. It's a blow to his fragile vanity. And that reminds me, to the classics I've mentioned, I'll add the Planet of the Apes films. I remember Don Murray in Conquest of the Planet of the Apes telling Roddy McDowell's Caesar exactly why humans hate the apes. They don't want to be reminded that no matter how far they evolve, they will always be part beast. Which makes this a good time to talk about the final member of this threesome, Gnee the Gorilla, as played by Mr. George Barrows. Born in 1914, he was an active stuntman, bit player in movies and TV for several decades, but became most famous as a gorilla performer. It was a curious specialty that began back in 1934 with his very first movie, Tarzan and His Mate. Barrows was the infamous Roman from 1953's Robot Monster, in essence a gorilla wearing a diving helmet. And a few years later, he also played the lead role in Frankenstein's Daughter, that character becoming, as a result of Barrows' casting, a rather burly lady monster. Many small roles in all kinds of TV shows followed. And while we know he played a gorilla in the old Abbott and Costello TV show, in the episode The Haunted Castle, he may or may not have played Bingo the Chief's father in the episode Safari. Anyway, my good friend Scott Skelton, the ultimate night gallery expert, absolutely hates this gorilla costume, and so do most fans and observers. I tend to be a little gentler on the subject. This is a fantasy gorilla, after all, a monster of sorts. It's supposed to be a bit unreal. Besides, some of the greatest science fiction episodes in TV history have been saddled with some of the dumbest-looking monsters ever created. For what it's worth, my mind had no problem accepting this ape as the episode's bear, to use Joe Stefano's term. It was the same way when Barrows donned his gorilla costume 5 years later to do battle with the Incredible Hulk in an early episode. You know, on top of that, I gotta say, I've never been fooled by traditional gorilla costumes in movies, big budget or small. You always know it's a guy in the suit. And, you know, this episode, I have to say, had so much going against it, weak script, bad direction, embarrassing acting, that the relative phoniness of the ape suit didn't faze me that much. Okay, for convenience and efficiency, director Finneman uses a freeze frame to suggest Gnee's removal from the Garden of Eden, so to speak, and the beginning of a new caged life in the world of his enemy, man. We see all these stock shots of wild animals and such in their natural, pure environment. But then, with a whip pan, we transition to the stinking mess humanity has made of his environment, an ugly and ruined world, something Ruth Wilson will be pontificating about a few scenes down the line. Dean Merrill, I'm pleased to say, has fared much better in other movie and TV shows, and she was what we used to call a New York society girl coming from a rich background and was soon off to Broadway, finally Hollywood. Her screen debut was in the Tracy Hepburn comedy Desk Set in the mid-50s. She appeared in many, many films. Actor Cliff Robinson was her second husband, and they made a bunch of movies together. Co-star Steve Forrest also enjoyed a robust career on the big and small screen. He was highly visible in the 50s and 70s in Flaming Star, The Longest Day, Mommy Dearest, whatever. On TV, he was best known for SWAT, and later a regular role in Dallas. He's also had better luck in the Night Gallery installment The Waiting Room, and one of the original Hour episodes of The Twilight Zone, The Parallel. That's the show, incidentally, where Rod Serling used the term Outer Limits, and may have accidentally named Leslie Stevens' new TV series, which was called Please Stand By at the time. That's just a theory of mine, but who knows. Actor Fernando Lamas has been introduced into the story as Dr. Ramirez, something of a voice of reason. After hearing the Wilsons interacting in these upcoming scenes here, he swiftly realizes that both of them are a little off their nut. Lamas, an MGM contract player in the 50s, he often swapped roles with Ricardo Montalban, enjoyed moderate stardom for a while as a handsome, rugged Latin lover. Actress Arlene Dahl was his third wife, and swimmer actress Esther Williams his fourth. These final scenes in the story are set in the artifact room of the museum, in actuality, the prop room at Universal. You know, I'd like to break off from specific comments about this episode to make some observations about where network television was in the 1972-1973 season. at least in terms of horror fantasy TV series. It was really a total weekend experience for us fans. On Friday, we'd settle in for William Castle's Ghost Story on NBC at 9 p.m. as a shiny new hour anthology with an amazing writing pedigree. Richard Matheson, Jimmy Sangster, all legendary names. Sad to say, the show fell short of its potential with only one episode, House of Evil by Robert Bloch, starring Jodie Foster and Melvin Douglas, being truly exceptional. The series struggled and was ultimately renamed Circle of Fear midway through its single-season run. Now we come to Saturday night. At 10 p.m. on ABC, it was The Sixth Sense, renewed after its first half-season and destined to be canceled after its second half-season. Following two failed attempts, one with Leslie Nielsen, the other with Louis Jourdan, Sense finally gave Universal the supernatural detective series it had always wanted for a network TV show. Now, here's the interesting thing about the arrival of Ghost Story. Just like back in the early 60s with Thriller and the Alfred Hitchcock Hour, NBC had two spooky anthologies on its primetime schedule, Ghost Story and Night Gallery. Pretty amazing when you think about it. And like Thriller, the two-year-old Night Gallery was being treated rather shabbily, cut down to a half hour, shoved off to late Sunday night. The only conversation there was that it was still, it followed the NBC mystery movie just as it had on Wednesday nights. And with Columbo episodes going through the roof, Night Gallery would often get a ratings boost from this powerful lead-in show. Which brings us back to what we're watching right now, which, as mentioned, was the highest rated Night Gallery ever aired, tied only with the two-hour pilot. Go figure, right? Regardless, the series was canceled by NBC, and Ghost Story Circle of Fear was also axed. Horror series would be off the networks until Universal's Kolchak, The Night Stalker, put a comedic cap on the genre in 1974. Okay, I also wanted to say something about Night Gallery's funky afterlife on local TV. Now included in this Blu-ray release is Craig Beam's excellent featurette, The Syndicated Conundrum, and it provides just about everything you need to know about Universal's infamous re-editing of the series, which was combined with even more severely edited Sixth Sense episodes, so that Gallery Cindy package would have a high enough episode count. Also included are the 25 60mm introductions that Serling filmed for the added Sense shows. I've been pushing to include these openings since Kino first got the Night Gallery license, and I'm so pleased a way was found to include them. Incidentally, there was a question about why the original two-hour pilot wasn't included in the syndicated package. The reason was, it had already been syndicated by Universal TV as a single feature film just 2 years earlier, in the same package with Fear No Evil and other Universal movies. In New York, this package wound up on WOR TV Channel 9. So a viewer could be watching Night Gallery, the two-hour pilot on Million Dollar Movie, at the same time he was checking out Night Gallery, the hour series on NBC's 4-in-1. I know, because that's exactly what I was doing. Now, the Night Gallery standalone pilot was also released as a VHS beta tape in the early 80s. The first time it was reunited with the rest of the series, eventually presented in hour form, was with the DVD set, which came out about a decade later.
That's why I'm giving him to you. I want you to turn him into a vegetable.
We just experienced Ruth's hateful, anti-male, ultimately anti-human bias. It's one strident and illogical utterance after another, and this dialogue is often singled out by critics as especially cringeworthy. Meanwhile, Grant Wilson is just as ridiculous in a different way, hating the gorilla irrationally as much as his wife seems to have fallen in love with it. Okay, apparently what is going on here is that two alpha males, one a Cro-Magnon man, the other a gorilla, were once mighty rivals in prehistoric times for the affections of a female. A female what? We don't know. And I really don't think we want to know. Anyway, evolution gave the caveman an edge, enabling him to create weapons. And this is something the gorilla apparently never forgave him for. Man was ultimately victorious over beast. Now both of them seem to be reenacting this great battle over and over again throughout history. So, that's the idea. And as these poor actors try to make this bizarre premise play without cracking up, the plot requires yet another leap of logic. Bad enough we have to hear Meryl's unconvincing line readings, but now she's telling her beloved ape things she couldn't possibly know, unless we somehow accept the notion that, as part of this eternal triangle, she has a preternatural awareness of the past. Now, it's that kind of story. I have to say, this final sequence in the museum's prop room proved to be quite an ordeal for director Jerry Finnerman. He put lights all over the place. He really did his best. Making matters worse, gorilla actor Barrows could only work in his cumbersome costume for a limited time before he'd start feeling dizzy. Nevertheless, with aggressive editing and some nice creative lighting effects, the scene does have a few good moments. The ape close-ups in the dark, as you'll see, are pretty disturbing, and the rushing toward the camera bit does have a primal shock value to it. Also want to mention something kind of funny, you know, maybe a little silly, but, you know, I'll be brave and get into this anyway. In a semi-interesting coincidence, the two-hour pilot of Night Gallery, which was really a feature-length episode comprised of three stories, left us with a tale that took place at a museum at night as a thunderstorm growled outside. And so does this show, the very last episode of Night Gallery. Very profound, right? But thought I'd mention it. Anyway, our plot is progressing, such as it is. And,
Howard, man, the weak one wins again.
Our strange little story is now, I guess, wobbling to its conclusion. But, you know, all of this kind of stuff is worth re-mentioning and even getting into some of the other films that have done this. You know, I suppose you could even say Creature from the Black Lagoon has elements of this. I mean, in that case, you had two alpha males, one played by Richard Carlson, the other Richard Denning, and a beautiful female sort of caught between them, Julie Adams. Now, granted, she had already chosen the Richard Carlson character who kind of represented white science right at the beginning. But, you know, these two guys, really good-looking, in great shape, with their shirts off most of the time, clearly, symbolically come across as rivals. And on a certain level, the creature, of course, is the added component and becomes a very interesting symbolic component. I mean, the David Reed character, played by Richard Carlson, has been holding off getting married. 6 months, he's kept Julie Adams waiting. That's Julie Adams, folks. Whereas the other character, who's just interested in himself, the Richard Denning character, probably just wants her as a trophy wife. And into this mix comes the creature with his penis-shaped head, and he basically just wants her. So we're presuming that Kay is probably a virgin, and she just wants some kind of love, which she's not getting with either of these alpha males. So again, the use of the, you know, playing the Beauty and the Beast angle and trying to use symbolism to explain what's really going on. So many films have done that very, very effectively. Here was a case of a little story that tried to, but really had a great deal of trouble doing it, probably because the characters were all thumbnails and we really couldn't get into them. And again, just so much of what they're saying really gets on our nerves. You know, it's on the nose. It's not convincing. But there is a certain amount of basic excitement that is being generated here with the editing and with the just obvious situation of people being trapped with a wild animal trying to get them. Some of these shots are quite good. I mean, there is a sense of drama here, but even then, you know, it's the tale will fall short. I mean, what can one say? Even the modest energy exhibited during the beginning of this climax finally succumbs to dreary, predictable plot requirements. Turnabout, alas, is fair play. You know, we're going to see what happens here. Eventually, of course, you know, our man has a weapon. And isn't it interesting how Dina Merrill's character, Ruth, suddenly went from this crazy parody of a woke extremist gone awry, I suppose, to someone who's just cowering and hoping that her man will protect her. Well, I suppose this is some way of getting back to the notion of the woman just being the prize and the two men being the ones who will battle for her. I guess the two kings, the gorilla was kind of suggested as a king in his world, a la King Kong, right? But the man does have the weapon, which makes all the difference. Of course, the screenwriter or teleplay writer only gave him a certain amount of bullets, so we have a little suspense here. He does have to kill this monster before the monster kills him. And I say it's a monster because it's clearly governed by forces way beyond what a normal animal would be, except, you know, you have this whole notion of animal instinct actually being a kind of memory in the blood. It was actually one of the few good lines in the script. So they are all, you know, reenacting this thing, and but it doesn't always turn out the same way, apparently. I mean, kind of the way the setup led you to believe it always does, that the man, who is the more advanced being, who knows how to create and use weapons, would invariably come out on top. But that isn't always necessarily the case. And at the key moment here in the climax, of course, a little turnaround idea is used. Otherwise, this is the big final confrontation between man and creature. And as mentioned before, you know, Steve Forrest and his brother was Dana Andrews. They both, you know, if you close your eyes and listen to their voices, they do sound very much alike. You could do the same thing with other actor brothers that are kind of famous. Well, there are just any number of them. James Arness of Gunsmoke and Peter Graves from Mission Impossible come to mind. But, you know, in this case, I would say Dana Andrews definitely had the stronger career, although Steve Forrest did work and was a decent enough actor in his own right to have a steady career. So as I said, the director, who was very, very upset with this episode, it was his real opportunity to shine, and it just became kind of one problem after another. Of course, the problem started with a story that had so many built-in problems to begin with that, as I said before, it's hard to believe that anyone could have really pulled it off. This bit of business has been done many times before, where the creature kind of disguises himself by hiding among other models or figures that look just like it, but of course he's the real creature. I believe that was also done in Jurassic Park. Part of the problem here is that the real creature looks kind of just as phony as the ones he's, you know, hiding among. So it's a bit of a problem. But again, as I say, you kind of go with it. Once you go with the whole notion of this, you kind of run with that.
Neo, boy, this has all happened before somewhere, long ago.
This idea of, well, he's dead, and that's the end of our story. Let me turn my back and walk away and consider the profound implications of this. Without realizing, of course, that the creature may indeed be playing possum. I mean, Mark Carducci and I played that same number in Pumpkinhead. It's been done any number of times. And it became something of a cliche in the 80s, where, like, even audiences would say, watch out, he's going to come back to get you. And as I said before, in this case, Turnabout is indeed fair play. The more advanced of the warriors doesn't necessarily win every time this epic battle is revisited, it seems. Yeah. Now, if I'm not mistaken, by the way, that's a sick little smile on Denise's lifeless face. So our final shot takes us from the hand of the dead man to the similarly outstretched hand of the dead gorilla to the gun, which gave Wilson his advantage, then finally to the shattered bust of Cro-Magnon Man. Is there some profound significance in this camera coverage? I think it's more like an exhausted director telling us, look, here are all the visual components of this wacky tale. Add them up yourself and see what you come up with. I'm done. And so are we, pretty much, at least with Hatred Unto Death, But for the first time in Night Gallery's final half-hour incarnation, one of those they're so bad they're good, except they're really not very good, comical blackouts makes an obtuse appearance. This little Jack Laird ditty was actually filmed for season two, but it somehow wound up here. Not a bad-looking vampire, by the way. You know, I wonder if this final line was actually meant to be read with a Jewish accent. It couldn't hurt. I mean, who knows? I guess it couldn't hurt. In any event, we've come a long way since Roddy McDowall scampered about his mansion shouting Portafoy at the drop of a hat. There were some great episodes, some good episodes, and a fair amount of just average episodes. But Night Gallery was never dull. Even Hatred Unto Death, for all its ludicrous aspects, moves along briskly, and the production values provided by Universal were generally first rate. Was Night Gallery a mod Twilight Zone, as TV Guide christened it? Yeah, to a certain degree. It was also frequently daring, audacious, heartfelt, and always entertaining. Take a well-deserved bow, Rod Serling, William Sackheim, and Jack Laird. Thanks for listening.